This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Donna Adelson back in court on February 26th for a hearing for her upcoming trial. Let's go to the courtroom right now and take a listen.
Prior to obtaining the subpoena, did you give any notice to the defense attorneys on behalf of Ms. Adelson that you were going to seek her medical records?
No.
Were you instructed to do that by anyone in the state attorney's office?
No.
Is this just typically the practice that you use to obtaining medical records without giving notice to the defense?
No, my understanding was Mr. Toomey said, please provide me a subpoena and I will bring the records with me to the hearing. That's the extent of what I understood to occur.
I don't have anything further at this witness.
Steven, do you have any other examination as to the subpoena or the obtaining of records?
No, sir.
You may step down, investigator. Mr. Hayden, if you can take the witness stand once again. Concerning the examination of Mr. Hayden, I will rule the following. Any knowledge that he has based on his independent review of the records as a member of the jail staff providing medical care to the inmates, if he has knowledge of the defendant's records, he certainly may testify on that basis. If the defense is continuing to object to any use of the records by the state today, that will be handled as a separate matter. However, as well, if there is going to be cross-examination as to the specifically objected to records, that is going to open the door on any redirect topics raised. You may continue your cross-examination at this point.
Thank you, Judge. You indicated in your testimony that you, at the jail, the health care that's provided would be for basic life-saving techniques. Is that it?
As far as emergency, yes, ma'am.
Just for emergencies?
Emergencies, yes. Okay. We don't have advanced life-saving medications. They have to be sent to the emergency room.
Okay, and you also indicated in your testimony that the medical care provider, the doctor, I guess, who it is, who may be treating an inmate who's requested medical care, makes their decision based on evidence. Is that right?
Evidence-based practice.
Okay, and your evidence-based practice, your testimony was, could be what they observed with the particular inmate and other evidence as well. Is that right?
So evidence-based practice is, we use a standard, like community, the same level of care that you'd get in the community is what we provide.
I'm sorry?
Use community-based practice. So the evidence is based on evidence-based practice.
And the evidence that you would have is whatever the inmate is providing to you, correct?
Well, so basically what it is if someone has heart failure, there's a system that we use to make sure that a patient is being cared for appropriately based on the indications, what the illness does to the body, things like that. So it's a standard way of practicing medicine.
And based on that practice, then, the standard way of practicing medicine, if someone tells you they're experiencing shortness of breath, you said an x-ray was done because she made that complaint, correct?
She was assessed, and then the provider also added the x-ray to that, yes.
Okay, and that's something that should be done as part
correct.
Of
a
normal, right?
Mm-hmm.
If someone says, I've got shortness of breath, you should get them for an x-ray. That's part of what should take place,
yes,
correct?
Ma'am.
Okay. Part of the medical care that's provided by your company, the Leon County Detention Facility, do you all do steroid injections in the spine?
No, that would be something that would be sent out for a consult to a specialist.
And do you do that without court order?
To provide care?
Yes.
Yes, we can provide care without a court order.
You do? That's the policy at the Leon County Detention Facility, that if a specialist is required, you all send the inmate out without a court order, without a required court order. If it's a non-emergency situation.
We send people out for non-emergency consults.
Okay, great.
Almost daily.
Yes, great. Ma'am. And as far as the hearing issue goes, you said that the decision about not doing the procedure within her ear, that's because you all don't provide it.
Currently, we just got this request, and this is something that is new to us. We never had any history or any records of that. When she made the issue, when she put the request in, she was assessed by the provider, and the provider saw nothing on her assessment. Not to say that if there is an actual need, we can accommodate that. We can coordinate her care.
So that was a recent request as far as you understand?
Yes, ma'am.
I don't have anything further.
Redirect examination.
Recent as in the request as to the ears occurred in occurred in February.
Correct.
Of 2025.
So reason is, you know, based on her medical history that she reported at the time she was booked in.
Okay. And the doctor did not notice any hearing loss at that time, or didn't note any hearing loss.
Right, based on the report, her assessment.
Okay. And every time she's seen, the doctors have reported that her respiratory system appeared clear. She appeared to have no issue receiving air.
Correct.
And her oxygen levels, her pulse oxygen levels, were always around about 98. Is that normal to be like between 96 and 100?
It's a normal range, yes.
Okay. For the cut that she received on Saturday, February 1st, she ended up receiving Neosporin and a Band-Aid for her cut?
Yes, and then they followed up, I believe it was a week after, about 7 days after the initial assessment, the skin protocol was initiated, and they found that there was no signs and symptoms of infection, and at that time she was educated to report any signs or any worsening of the condition.
And she did receive a tetanus shot?
Yes.
Just in case. That's all.
You may step down, Mr. Hayden. Let's resume with the suppression aspect of this at this time. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Let's resume with the suppression portion at this time. Does the defense have any other witnesses or evidence it wishes to present as it relates to the burden in this matter?
Yes, Your Honor. Defense will call Donna Adelson.
Please come up to the witness stand, Ms. Adelson. Witness stand. Yeah. Please raise your right hand as best as you can. Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give will be the truth?
Yes.
You may take the seat. Please speak loudly and clearly. You may examine Mr. Zellman when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please state your name for the record and make sure you speak into the microphone.
Yes, Donna Adelson.
Now, I want to direct your attention. We heard the call earlier. The call on November 7th of 2023 at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and for the record, that was call number 561. Do you remember where you were?
Yes, I was in my apartment in my living room.
Do you remember who was present when you got the call?
Yes, my husband, Harvey, and friends of mine, my attorney, Susan Brotman, and her husband, Richard Chagrin.
You said your attorney. What kind of law does Ms. Brotman practice? Or did she?
She does estate planning.
Was Ms. Brotman present at your apartment for the purposes of providing you with legal counsel?
Yes, she was.
And you remember receiving the call from Charlie?
Yes, of course.
And where was Charlie at the time?
So he was in a room by himself. It was after the conviction.
Was he in the jail?
He was in jail.
Okay. What did you do when you saw that Charlie was calling?
Answered the phone.
And you heard the recording that we played earlier?
Yes.
And you agreed for your call with your son to be recorded, correct?
Yes.
As the call was happening, do you know at what point Charlie was no longer on the call?
No, only when because I was talking, and then all of a sudden I asked him something, and I said, "Charlie, do you hear me, Charlie?" And I said it a few times, and he didn't respond anymore. And I knew the call was over.
Now, during the time that your son was incarcerated in Leon County Jail, did that happen more than you know, was that a frequent occurrence?
Yeah, it happens. It happens a lot, unfortunately.
Okay. And would there be times when you didn't realize at first that he was no longer on the call?
Yes.
Where in your apartment were you when this happened?
So I was in my living room.
And you heard your voice on that first call number 562, when you repeated, you know, Charlie, Charlie, are you there?
Right.
Did you believe the call had ended?
Yes.
And what would, in times prior to this, what would happen after that? What would you do when that would happen?
If he didn't respond anymore, that was it. The call was over.
And what would you do with your phone?
I'd hang up.
Now, same thing with the call on November 8th of 2023, the one at 6:30 in the morning. Do you know at what point your son was no longer on the phone?
I don't. I don't remember at all.
In either one of those situations, or in both of the situations, did you believe the call was over?
Yeah, the call was over. He was gone.
And you went about your business?
Yes.
Now, with respect to the November 7th, 2023 phone call when your attorney, her husband, and your husband were present at your apartment. Did you agree for your attorney-client conversation to be recorded?
No.
Did you agree for your conversation with your husband to be recorded?
No, of course not.
Now, the following day, did you agree for your subsequent conversation with your husband to be recorded?
No.
Heard the recording to consent to this call, press 1, or recording of this call, press 1, correct?
Correct.
And you hung up the phone after those calls were over?
Thought I did.
Just a moment, Your Honor. Nothing further at this time, Your Honor?
Cross-examination.
So there in the room with you during this call was, you said your one of your attorneys, Susan Brotman, your husband, and then also Susan Brotman's husband.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And he was not your attorney?
He was not.
Your attorney?
No, he's not an attorney.
Okay. You were informed at the beginning of that call, this is the one on November 7th that recorded you while they were all in the room. You were informed that you were being recorded if you accepted that call?
Yes.
Okay. And that if you do not want to be on that recorded call, that you needed to hang up the call. Is that right?
Are you saying, does the recording say?
Right. If you do not want to accept that recorded call, you should hang up.
If you do not, yeah, no, I accepted the recorded call.
Okay. And you typically do hang up your calls, you said, after.
I mean, I think I did.
Your call with Charlie Adelson when he was in custody. All right, but this particular call that day, evidently, you did not properly hang up, right?
Evidently.
Okay. And have you ever forgotten to press the button on a call before?
I mean, it may have happened. I don't know.
Sure. Has your phone pocket dialed people before?
Know. Has it what?
Pocket dialed people before? I mean, when you've been out of custody.
Pocket dialed?
Right.
I don't know what you mean.
Like if your phone is in your pocket or in your purse and it accidentally calls someone you didn't mean it to?
I mean, it could have happened, sure.
Okay. And you also could have not pressed the button on your cell phone to end a call before, right?
It's possible.
Okay. It's not quite as big of a deal as it used to be when you would actually have to like, hang up the phone.
Right.
Okay. That's all. Thank you.
Redirect examination.
Briefly, Your Honor. The consent that you gave for the call to be recorded, when did that end?
It ended when Charlie hung up, or when it, whatever stopped the call. I mean, I don't know how it stopped, but it stopped. When the call was over with Charlie, it was over.
Nothing further.
You may step down. As to the burden at this point, under the precedent established by Smiley versus State, in order to exclude what are complained of wiretapped interceptions, the movement has a need to show there was a subjective expectation of privacy in their statements, and the expectation is one that society would accept as reasonable. As to the subjective expectation showing, the defendant has met that burden. It now shifts to the state as to whether this is one that is reasonable. Ms. Dugan?
Yes, sir. I have argument.
You may proceed.
May I provide the court with some case law?
You may.
I've got some argument, and then I'll kind of go through each one of these cases. I provided a defense copy of these earlier this morning. So in defendant's motion, they first argued that this was, you know, a warrantless search. However, the state's argument is that this is not subject to Fourth Amendment, so there's no wrongful state action that caused this defendant to be reported after the inmate was no longer on the call. The only conceivable state action here was the state having this service that allows inmates to make recorded calls. But on those calls, both parties have to consent to be recorded for the call to begin. And if they do not want to be recorded or need to hang up, the state didn't intend to record this defendant's conversation in her home with her husband and friends. And it was the fact that she was recorded was not caused by the state's actions. It was caused by the defendant's actions. The defendant argues that they have expectation of privacy in the call, but that would only start once this defendant actually hangs up. And the defendant is the one responsible for hanging up, not the state. The defendant was responsible for the interception of the phone call. It was her failure to hang up that caused that rest of that call to be recorded. It was her action and not the state action that made that happen. The state did nothing to keep her from hanging up the phone or prevent her from hanging up the phone. I think an analogy here would be if someone were to say something incriminating in earshot of a law enforcement officer because they think the law enforcement officer can't hear them, if they can actually hear them, then that's on the speaker because the speaker didn't walk away to talk. That was the speaker's carelessness. The defense also cites Florida Statute 934 and says that the good faith exception doesn't apply because this call was in violation of that statute. But when you look at 934.03, every single subsection of that statute applies to intentional intercepts, not accidental. I provided several cases to the court. There's nothing directly on point here of this situation having happened just like this in the past, but there are a lot of cases that deal with inadvertent recordings. One of the first cases I gave to you is Baranek. This is a U.S. Court of Appeals case from the Sixth Circuit that held that police interceptions, conversations between the defendants that was overheard when
cell phone that was subject to a court-authorized wiretap was inadvertently left off the hook by the defendant. That was authorized under the plain view exception to the warrant requirement. In that case, the state had an actual Title III wire on the defendant's phone. The defendant was on a call and then didn't properly hang up the call. They left the phone off the hook accidentally. And then law enforcement was able to hear the conversation in the room where that phone was located. So when you compare that to our case, there's obviously, you know, a much different type of state action in that case with a wire. But regardless, this was a recorded line. It was a legally recorded line where they consented to be recorded. Just like in our case, though, the defendant in that case failed to properly hang up, and that allowed law enforcement to hear the conversation in the room. And that was ruled to be authorized because of the inadvertent nature of the recording. Another was Otero versus State. This is a third DCA case from Florida where a child accidentally activated an answering machine of a home that she was staying at. And that answering machine recorded the conversation of the mother and the child, unbeknownst to either of them. The third DCA found that admission of that tape into evidence did not violate the statutory exclusionary rule found in 934, because 934 prohibits intentional interception of wire communication. And that taping in that case was accidental, not intentional, just like in our case. There's another case that I provided to the court, Bell versus State. In that case, a girlfriend began to record her conversation with her boyfriend, who was the appellant. And that conversation that she wanted to record was about money, an argument about money between them. The appellant, Bell, then took the phone from her and kept the phone after the argument ended and the girlfriend left the house. The girlfriend's young daughter was still at the house, and after the girlfriend left, the defendant was intoxicated and forgot to turn off the audio recording. There was then a recording. As the recording kept going, it recorded him molesting the girlfriend's young daughter after the girlfriend left the house. The girlfriend then discovered the audio recording next day and handed it over to the police. The defendant was charged with L&L molestation. In that case, the recording of this molestation was obviously inadvertent, and the defendant agreed with that. Only the first conversation about money was what the girlfriend was trying to intend before the phone was taken from her. And that phone was in the appellant's custody and control at the time of this recording of the L&L molestation. The DCA in that case said that the trial court did not err in concluding that Mr. Bell failed to prove that his girlfriend intentionally intercepted the portion of the recording that took place while she was gone. Unless his girlfriend intentionally violated the statute, he was not entitled to the benefit of the statutory exclusionary rule. Because the recording was suspicious, but after she warned him she was going to record him, he took possession of the device that recorded his words and actions. And so the court found that the appellant did not establish that the communications were intercepted under any circumstances justifying an expectation of privacy. I have one more case that concerns the reasonable expectation of privacy. This is the Huff case that I provided to the court, which is a federal case where the plaintiff, a federal civil case, where the plaintiff inadvertently pocket dialed the defendant, which is something that, you know, has happened to us all. And the defendant listened to and recorded the conversation she overheard while on the pocket dial call. The plaintiff then brought suit for the defendant intentionally intercepting this private conversation. And in that conversation, the plaintiff was basically having a discussion with his wife and with other people as well in the room. The court ruled that the plaintiff's statements did not qualify under Title III because he exposed them to the defendant when he pocket dialed her. But the plaintiff's wife's statements did qualify. She can't be held responsible for her husband's pocket dial. But the thing that I think is most important about that case is the court's holding that a person who knowingly operates a device that is capable of inadvertently exposing his conversation to third-party listeners and fails to take simple precautions to prevent such exposure does not have a reasonable expectation of privacy with respect to statements that are exposed to an outsider by the inadvertent operation of that device. So in that case, the statements didn't qualify under that were as ones that were protected under the U.S. Code. And that's what we have here. We have the defendant failing to take simple precautions of properly hanging up what she knows is a recorded call. So the state would ask that the defense motion be denied.
Final argument on the motion to suppress from the defense.
Yes, Your Honor. There are two cases, and I cited a number of cases, and I know Your Honor's practice is to review those. In addition, there are two additional cases I provided copies to the state that I am relying on. The first is Hentz versus State, 62 Southern 3rd, 1184, and State versus Mozo, 655 Southern 2nd, 1115. May I approach?
You may.
Thank you. So, Your Honor, I want to start with a very general proposition that's important for us to remember. Right to privacy is enshrined in the Florida Constitution. Article 1, Section 23 provides that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures and against the unreasonable interception of private communications by any means shall not be violated. Article 1, Section 23, the Florida Constitution also provides that every natural person has a right to be let alone and free of governmental intrusion into the person's private life. Fourth Amendment includes similar protections. 934.02 defines an oral communication as any oral communication uttered by a person exhibiting an expectation that such communication is not subject to interception under circumstances justifying such expectation. The courts have held in Florida, as cited in my motion, for an oral conversation to be protected, the speaker must have an objective expectation of privacy along with a societal recognition that the expectation is reasonable. Your Honor, State versus Mozo, almost 20 years ago, courts have held that conversations, oral communications taking place in one's home are protected by Chapter 934.
I don't think this point is reasonably in dispute, but okay. Go ahead.
Now, the question, obviously, is the objective portion of this test. And Hentz versus State, 4th DCA, and Hentz is a situation, Your Honor, where an individual was in an interview room at the police department. He placed a call to essentially a co-defendant. And the recording equipment was powerful enough in that interview room to pick up the other end of the call that is made to Hentz. Based on what law enforcement heard from the individual's call, the individual who is calling Mr. Hentz, they obtained a search warrant for his cell phone. And on that cell phone, they found images that are illegal to possess, as well as other evidence of a crime that the two of them engaged in. The Hentz court held that, and another important factor, Your Honor, Mr. Hentz was aware that the individual on the other end of the phone was at the police department waiting to speak to law enforcement. Court held that Hentz had a subjective expectation of privacy and his expectation was one society accepts as reasonable. Now, one distinguishing factor I need to acknowledge that, but I submit it's not dispositive, is that while Hentz did not know that the individual was sitting in a police interview room, whereas Mrs. Adelson knew that Charlie was in jail and had consented to her call with Charlie being recorded. But the oral communication that is protected by Chapter 934 that is at issue here are the conversations that Mrs. Adelson had after Charlie dropped off the call, when she believed the call was no longer being recorded, conversation, at least with respect to the November 7th, is with her attorney and her husband. Both are confidential relationships.
Doesn't the warning, though, about the recording almost directly speak to that issue where, I'll read the case that you've given me about hints. Although he knew his friend was at the police station, he never received an explicit warning about you may be recorded if you continue on this conversation.
Correct, and I'm going to get to that, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The testimony, uncontroverted testimony, is that Mrs. Adelson believes she hung the phone up once she realized Charlie was no longer on the call. There's no evidence otherwise. And I don't think it is reasonable to require an individual in a situation like that, I just had a recorded phone call, let me repeatedly hit the end button. Hit it once, that should be enough. She believed that she ended the phone call. Now, Hentz also addressed something else that I think is important. Chapter 934.03 is a general intent statute. It does not require that the state intentionally recorded after one party of this jail call drops off. It's not required. Wasn't the system designed to intentionally record? The answer has to be yes. Investigator Newland testified, yes, intentionally designed to record. Now, the state, I anticipated that they would argue accident or inadvertence. This is not an accident. An accident is something that doesn't happen frequently. Mrs. Adelson testified that Charlie dropping off the call would happen frequently. And as Investigator Newland acknowledged in Defense Exhibit 3 and Defense Exhibit 1 established, this was not an isolated issue. This happened. The system is intentionally designed to continue recording. Under Chapter 934, I submit that when either side of the call is no longer on the call, that the system has to stop recording, and any additional recording is a violation. And that's what we have here. This is not an accident. This is not inadvertent. Securus Technologies system is designed to continue to record after either one of those parties drops off the call. Investigator Newland said that it terminates when both parties hang up. Well, I submit, Your Honor, that that's not what happens. It continues to record, and it is not reasonable, and society is not expecting that somebody sit there with their phone and continue to hit the end button to make sure that the call stops on their end. I think that's
But do you have to continue to hit the end button, or you hit it once, it's disconnected?
Testimony is that she believes she did.
Go ahead.
So, because this is not a specific intent statute, is the system designed to intend to record? Yes. And there's no evidence that this was accidental or inadvertent. This is not a pocket dial, as the state argued. We know that Charlie intentionally called his mom. We know that the system intentionally recorded the call. The state has not presented sufficient evidence to establish this is not a communication that that there's a reasonable expectation that society would accept that this call is anything other than something that is entitled to the protection of 934 and the Florida Constitution.
And we'll review the cases that were presented by both parties before making any ruling. I'll reserve on the ruling as to today. We'll take a brief 5-minute break before we get into the Arthur and Bond motion. We'll be in recess.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Everyone can be seated. Let's move on to the second part of the hearing this morning. The motion to set bond and also for Arthur hearing.
Thank you, Judge. May I put one more thing on the record for the suppression that I had in my notes and I forgot to say it?
Only one?
One.
Just one. Go ahead.
So in the call that the defense moved into evidence, the call from November 7th, that's in dispute here. At the end of the call, Harvey Adelson says something along the lines of, the last thing that you hear, something along the lines of, what's this, a call that didn't end? The implication being he must have picked up the phone and saw that the call didn't end. I think this is important to note because had Donna Adelson looked at her phone, she would have seen the same thing. That's all.
May I have an equally brief response?
59 seconds exactly.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Your Honor, the system, the secure system, is intentionally designed to continue reporting after the inmate disconnects. And the system knew that Charlie had been disconnected because he tried calling back, and the system reflected, as Investigator Newland testified, account in use.
Let's move on to the Arthur hearing at this portion. Is the defense wishing to present its argument as to bond, or is the state going to present first as to proof of guilt evident or presumption grade?
I'd prefer we do bond first, if that's okay with the defense, just because the state does have a couple of witnesses asked to the things they brought up in their motion. And then I'm not calling any witnesses for Arthur. I'll just be moving some things into evidence, so maybe we could do that last.
Mr. Zellman, as to the bond portion of this, do you have witnesses?
We do, Your Honor. State would call Donna Adelson.
So, Adelson, you can retake the stand once again. You remain under oath. You are sworn to tell the truth. Examine when you go, Ms. Fulford.
Thank you, Judge. Ms. Adelson, at the commencement of the hearing on the motion to suppress you said your name for the record, Donna Adelson. Can you tell the court how many times prior to your arrest for the charges that are pending in this case have you been arrested for criminal offenses?
Never.
And how long were you incarcerated at the Leon County Detention Facility? Do you recall?
15 and a half months, 470 days.
And within that period of time, the 470 days, have you been held in the same location in the Leon County Detention Facility or different locations?
Different locations.
Okay, and your first location was where?
First location was in solitary confinement on a direct observation unit.
Do you know how long you were there?
50 days.
Okay. And where did you go following solitary?
To the N pod, like N is in November. It's an open pod, general population.
And what does that mean, open pod, general population?
So I was with 60-some-odd other inmates, all in one open area.
And you had beds in your room, I assume?
There were each sections off about 10 women, so, and there'd be a cement wall, and then there'd be another 10 women and a cement wall, so it was fairly quiet, actually, even with that many women, because we were separated in small groups, so it wasn't that loud.
Okay, and do you recall when you were taken out of the inn like Nancy pod?
Yes, in August, they said they had maintenance to do, and that we would be moved to the annex, which is a building outside of the jail.
Okay, and so I'm not going to be specific as to dates, but you're arrested in November of 2023 in solitary confinement for 50 days to whatever date that took you to?
January 9th.
Okay, and then from January 9th all the way through some date in August of 2024.
Correct.
You were in the inn like Nancy Pott. And then you said you were transferred to the annex. Can you describe the conditions inside the annex, please?
So the annex is kind of a temporary type building. It's not a brick building. It's kind of like a temporary building. And and there are 66 women all in bunk beds, all open. You're kind of one on top of the next. There's no separation at all.
So one big open room,
one
if you
big
will.
Open room with 66 beds. Yes.
Okay. And how long did you stay? So from August of 2024 until when? How long did you stay in the annex?
I was moved again on February 3rd, 2025.
Okay. Okay. And you were here when the gentleman was testifying about the call buttons to alert someone if you're having a medical emergency. Was there one of those in the N pod?
No.
Was there one in the annex?
No.
Okay. I'd like to start here. The motion for a bond that we filed in this case, as the court indicated earlier, one of the issues that we have raised are medical conditions that you're facing. So I'd like to start with your medical conditions and present some testimony to the court about those, okay?
Okay.
Okay. We're not going to go over every medical condition you've had since you've been incarcerated in the jail, but I'd like to start with one that you have that's causing you some pain in your leg and back area.
Yes.
Okay. Let me just start with this. Can you describe to the court the kind of pain and discomfort that you're having with this particular injury or issue?
Yeah, I know what it is because I've had it in the past. It's sciatic pain, and I get like a pulling kind of shooting pain down my legs.
Okay. Yeah. And you said you've had it in the past. You mean prior to becoming incarcerated
yes.
in Leon County Jail?
Yes.
Okay. And during the course of time before you were incarcerated at the Leon County Jail, did you seek treatment for that condition?
Yes, I did.
And what type of treatment did you obtain for that?
So I saw my orthopedist, and he gave me a steroid injection in my spine.
Okay. How long were you suffering from the sciatic condition prior to becoming incarcerated?
How long the last episode?
Before you were incarcerated in jail, for how many years had you been suffering with the sciatic issue?
So, no, I had it last about 10 years ago. I haven't had it all this time.
Okay.
But then it recurred a few months ago.
Okay. And what was the treatment that you were provided prior to your incarceration for your sciatic condition?
It was the steroid injection, and within 48 hours, it was gone. The pain was gone. It was amazing.
And where did they do the steroid injection? Where is that in your body?
In my spine.
Spine. Okay. Is that an outpatient procedure, inpatient?
Yes, outpatient.
Outpatient. Okay. All right. And during the course of time that you've been in the Leon County Jail, did you start to experience the sciatic pain again?
Yes, I did.
And what did you do when you started to experience that pain?
I wrote a sick call, and I went to see the doctor.
Okay. Where do you get these sick call forms from?
From the nurse.
Okay. And when do you have the opportunity to see a nurse for sick call forms?
Well, they come twice a day. They come in the morning, and they come in the evening.
Okay. And we'll get to what those times are at a later point. But if you don't get a form from a nurse, is there another way to obtain it that you're aware of?
No, that's the only way I've ever gotten it is from a nurse.
Okay. Do you recall approximately how far into your incarceration you started having the sciatic issues again?
I didn't have it until I was in the annex. So that was sometime over the last, I've been there 6 months. I don't remember the specific date, but I didn't have it before the annex.
Okay. And once you started experiencing it in the annex, did you complete a form to see medical attention?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And as a result of completing that form, did you have an opportunity to meet with someone in the medical center at the Leon County Jail?
I saw the doctor there,
and
yes.
And what happened?
And I explained what I had, and she said, we do not treat that type of problem. We could offer you some Tylenol.
And did they provide you with Tylenol?
They did.
And has that relieved you of the pain that you suffer?
No, it's Tylenol. It's not gonna do what I need to have done, no.
Okay. So sometimes since you've been in the annex, you made your request for treatment for the sciatic issue. Have you requested treatment more than once?
Yes.
Okay, and have you received any additional opportunities to meet with any of the medical staff regarding this pain?
No.
Okay. What happens when you request treatment and you don't get to see them? Do they tell you that you're not going to be allowed to see them again? What
no. happens? I usually wait a week, and if I don't hear anything, then I'll write another one, and I'll write, this is a second request or this is a third request. And then I think I got an answer. They sometimes just answer it and give it to the pod officer, and she'll hand out papers at night, which is the response to your requests. And on that one, they said, you're already getting pain medication for this. That was the Tylenol.
And the pain medication is just regular Tylenol?
Regular Tylenol.
Okay. At some point, did you have an opportunity to speak to someone in medical care regarding way to resolve some of the pressure in your leg for use of a medical mattress?
Yes. While I was down with the doctor during one visit, she said, you know what might be helpful, because you're sleeping on metal and the mattress is maybe a half inch thick, maybe. She said, what would help is if I could get a medical mattress for you. I had never heard that term before, but I said, okay, if you think it'll help, that would be great. And she left the room, she went into another room, and then she came back in and said, yeah, I thought that would be a good idea, but they don't have it here. So my best thoughts for you would be to get a second mattress, so it'll thicken it a little bit, and that might give you some relief at night.
Okay. And did you obtain a second mattress?
I did.
And this was while you were in the annex?
Well,
how did you get the additional mattress?
So the pod officer asked one of the inmates to go where they have extra mattresses. They have piles of 20, 30 mattresses there, to go get one of the extra mattresses and put it on my bed so that I had the extra mattress.
Okay. And during the time that you were allowed to have the additional mattress, did you get any relief?
Yes, at night, because I used to get the pains even if I was just lying down. And that definitely relieved some of the pain at night, so that was good.
Okay. And at some point, did they take the additional mattress away?
Yes. So on February 3rd, I was moved out of the annex to protective custody in the main jail building. And since I've been there, the officer removed the second mattress.
Okay.
She said, why do you have this? And I told her why. And she said, well, you have this.
Okay. And
so they took it away.
Okay. And since the additional mattress has been taken away, have you started to experience worsened pain?
Yeah, it's worse.
Okay. And have you requested any medical treatment for that?
Well, I spoke to the doctor, I don't remember the date, shortly after it was taken away. I was down for a different reason, and she said, yeah, I thought it was a good idea, but if you can't have it, you can't have it.
Okay. All right. Now, the relief that you got when you were able to have the additional mattress, did that completely take away the pain?
No.
Okay.
No.
And do you experience this pain when you're walking, sitting? What?
So, beginning, I was just getting it when I was walking. So it limited the amount of walking I could do, but I get it when I'm sitting, I get it lying down, I get it all the time now. So it's not like I have it all the time. It comes and goes, but when it just comes, I could be sitting, I could be standing, it just happens.
Okay. We're going to go into more details about how it took place in a few more minutes, but for now I'd like to talk about, are there any other areas that you are experiencing any pain?
Yes, I have a problem with my left arm.
And what, describe to the court what that problem is, what you're feeling, what you're experiencing.
So I have like shooting pain from the top here of my shoulder down the outside of my arm into my forearm.
Okay, and you're pointing to your left arm. Is that the one you're referring to?
It's my left arm.
Okay.
And so shooting pain down the arm, anything into your hands?
Yeah, it's, the pain is like, it's like hot. It's like a burning pain. And I, and my thumb, index, and middle finger have gotten like tingling. It almost feels like ants are crawling on them. It's like a numbness of those fingers.
Okay. And is this pain that you were experiencing prior to your incarceration at Lehigh County Jail?
No.
Okay. About when did this pain begin?
So I was assaulted by another inmate while I was here in the beginning of October.
October 2024?
Yes.
Okay. And when you say the Lehigh County Jail?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Since you began experiencing that pain, since October of 2024, have you requested medical treatment?
Yes.
And what has the response been?
They said they would take an x-ray, but in the meantime, I could have Tylenol.
Okay. And you said that was in approximately October of 2024. Have you been requesting treatment for that pain since October of 2024?
Several times.
Okay.
Yes.
And you heard the testimony of the gentleman previously. At some point, did they do an x-ray on your arm?
Yes.
And when was that?
It might have been February 3rd. No, that's the day I moved. Shortly after February 3rd. I don't know the date.
Was it after you were removed and placed in protective custody?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Is the Tylenol helped with the pain that you're experiencing?
No.
That's the latest from the courtroom. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you get podcasts so you don't miss any of our breaking updates and continuing live coverage on the trial of Donna Adelson. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.